You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The IWW, the International Workers of the World, was an organization founded in 1905. Its aim was to create one big union that included all workers. Indeed, the nickname for members of the IWW, the Wobblies, owes its origin to just this openness. The story goes that a Chinese restaurant owner in Vancouver supported the union, and he would provide a tab to all members of the IWW. But he was not able to pronounce the word W, so he would ask patrons if they belonged to the I Wobble Wobble. Workers then began to refer to themselves by this name, saying that I belong to the I Wobbly Wobbly. The nickname was appropriate, as it referred to both the good-natured atmosphere of the IWW movement and also to its international multi-ethnic character. Michel S. Beaulieu has joined us to discuss the IWW. He is an assistant professor of history at Lakehead University. He is the author of Reacting to the Workers' Revolt, the Lakehead and the Winnipeg General Strike. Good morning, Michel.
Good morning.
So let's talk a little about the character of the IWW. How were they different from traditional unions?
Well, one of the things that made the IWW very distinct from the trade unions and other unions that were existing in the early 20th century was that three things is, one, they sort of rejected the idea of signing contracts. The other thing is that they tended to be more industrial-orientated, so not just craft-based workers, but industrial workers. And they are also much more embracing of multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and individuals from various race, creeds, and languages.
And was that multi-ethnic character, that multi-racial character, was it a genuine thing, or was it just a sort of principle?
I think it was both. I mean, one of the things that makes the IWW unique for much of its history is that a lot of socialist organizations espouse equality and equal treatment of everyone, regardless of where they come from or who they are. But one of the things that drew workers to the IWW is they seem to have, by and large, at least especially in the Canadian context, to have actually done this in practice. One of the really fascinating things about their meetings, especially prior to the Second World War, was that they would be multilingual. They would take often a poll of those who were in attendance in a workers' hall, and they would, as much as possible, try to actually ensure that everything was translated into those various languages.
You've also mentioned contracts. Why were the Wobblies against contracts?
At least from the research I've been doing, one of the fundamental things is that the industrial workers of the world believe very firmly in the idea that workers, above all else, have the last thing that workers have against everything else against them is to withhold their work. And a lot of Wobblies viewed the idea of a binding contract as abrogating that basic sort of human right of workers. When everything goes wrong, the one thing a worker always has is the ability to stop work and leave the job, thus causing the situation where then the employer has to deal with them. And they viewed contracts as basically a way of subverting that, and a way of many sort of capitalists to actually be able to control that basic right.
And what was the Wobblies' issue with the traditional trade unions and their practices?
Part of it had to do, in some ways, the idea that a lot of, by the early 20th century, a lot of trade unions had opted to work within the existing structure within the existing state. And the Wobblies firmly believed in sort of their version of Marxism, which was that the state and the current structure of the system of economics was actually was part of the problem. And that by working within it, you were sort of a reformist, or you're sort of in some ways justifying it. It's one of the reasons why the IWW also firmly believed, and one of its core beliefs was non-political involvement. It didn't endorse political parties, it didn't run politicians, because they believed that was just another means of creating the status quo. The other reason why they were sort of established was they were unhappy with the sort of exclusive nature of much of the unionism during the time. A lot of the early members of the IWW were recent immigrants, especially in Canada and the United States, and these were individuals who were sort of blocked from participating in those trade unions that often were heavily craft-based, heavily Anglo-based and centered. And the IWW also appealed because they provided, their big thing was they provided a voice for the voiceless and marginalized workers, including in the United States and Canada, African Americans or blacks in Canada, women as well. So that was part of their appeal.
And the Wobblies, one of their strategies or tactics was direct action. How did that manifest itself?
Well, it's actually related somewhat to the idea of not wanting to sign actual contracts. One of the foremost beliefs, sort of again, was the idea that what a worker has and what a worker has the right to do is withhold their work. And because workers didn't control the means of production, because of the capitalist system, that this was the way that they could actually, in some ways before the system changed, dictate or attempt to dictate what occurred. So direct action was looked at as a manifestation of this, the general strike or the wildcat strikes, the ability to just walk off the job when the working conditions or the situation became too oppressive.
And how did that work in practice? Was it an effective technique?
In British Columbia and in Northern Ontario in particular, during the first half of the 20th century, it was actually quite effective in the 1920s and 30s. One of the things that's happened over time is a lot of revisionism occurred. I mean, the communists were great for this in the 1930s and 40s and 50s in Canada, I guess most of the world. But also a lot of, not to slight them, but a lot of trade unions as well seem to have forgotten the IWW. And in the work in the lumber camps of British Columbia and Northern Ontario, they were heavily influential in the 20s and 30s. Providing that sort of grassroots beginning sort of wedge into better working conditions, better wages, and better treatment. And a lot of what they fought for, quite successful in the 1920s, actually, especially in Northern Ontario, eventually made its way into both sort of mainstream trade unionism. It also made its way into various provincial and federal legislation following the post-war.
And what about the Wildcat Strike? They were one of the organizations to pioneer the Wildcat Strike. How effective a technique was that?
Well, I mean, it was in remote single resource or resource areas, very effective. One of the things that's a unique characteristic of resource industries, either it be harvest fields in the prairies, mining or lumber in the British Columbia, Alberta, Northern Ontario, and Quebec, and also in the East Coast, was they're seasonal. So what you do need to get is when workers get in there for seasonal work, there's a small time limit in which effective the employer can basically utilize and make their money. So when you have a wildcat strike occur, it directly hits the bottom line of the employer and causes havoc throughout the basically the entire system. Another way that the IWW sort of influenced is, I mean, although they weren't directly involved in the Winnipeg General Strike, those that were involved in the Winnipeg General Strike in many ways found inspiration, as well as a lot of the commonality with the IWW as it had been active before the First World War. And they sort of inspired what occurred in Winnipeg in 1919.
Well, the Wildcat Strike is one radical tactic. What about sabotage? Did the Wobblies engage in any of that?
This is the big debatable thing. Certainly in many elements of the IWW, especially the more radical elements. And the IWW would be syndicalist, but it also had anarcho-syndicalist tendencies. And those that sort of went towards some of the more violent forms of anarchism, definitely in the United States as well as in some parts of Canada, did participate in forms of sabotage. Now, sabotage is an interesting one because anyone who's ever worked in a workplace, a factory or something that basically does manufacturing, there's many ways that sabotage could be interpreted where, and this was famous of the IWW, where conditions or the employer would abuse or the supervisor would abuse, their complaints weren't heard, and all of a sudden a wrench would find its way into a machine. It would shut down the entire activity and basically was a form of protest. And on the one hand, it is sabotage, but sometimes it was sort of overblown. By and large, in Canada, the more violent actions that you would hear about in the United States didn't occur. I mean, they occurred in some cases, but a lot of what would be sabotage was workplace stoppage, which would be interpreted as that.
And workplace stoppage, how did that work?
Well, it's basically, like I said, I mean, in the lumber camps, what you would have is often machinery would mysteriously break. So you were in the process of either harvesting or you'd be in the process of splitting, woods for transport, and machinery would break down mysteriously. You know, it just would happen to coincide with either the reduction of wages or promises that at the beginning of the season that were expected to come through hadn't occurred. And then in the case of Northern Ontario, the employers would then call in the police, and they would say that there was sabotage by socialists and radicals. There'd be an investigation. People would be basically fired. And then a myth sort of would revolve or evolve out of that. But it was effective. In the case of Northern Ontario and parts of British Columbia, you actually did have then concessions reached because, I mean, these weren't sort of how the state and the RCMP and the various police would portray them as sort of stupid immigrants. I mean, these were very intelligent individuals who would pick that proper, precise moment of when all of a sudden, you know, machinery would break down at the most effective time to basically get their demands heard.
And why did the IWW fail to achieve its goal of one big union?
Well, part of it is that its strength is also its weakness. I mean, the IWW appealed to the marginalized and appealed to the voiceless. And unfortunately, in Canada and in the United States, the voiceless and the marginalized are often also demonized or viewed very negatively by the state. In the Canadian context, prior to the First World War, most of the members of the IWW were Ukrainian, they were Finnish, Italian, immigrants from various parts of the world that were looked at as, in many cases, because of our immigration policy and our and the mainstream Canadian culture, as sort of not as superior, not as civilized. So when the government went to basically target or basically when the government didn't want to have people involved in the IWW, they were able to build upon ethnic prejudice and racism within the country. And it effectively stopped the IWW from mobilizing into a much larger mass movement. On the other hand, that's also what its success was. And this is the same thing that's occurred in the post-Second World Wars as well. The IWW has cropped up periodically in Canadian history, and it has never been as numerically strong as it was in the 19-teens and 20s, but it appeared up again during the Civil Rights Movement and sort of in filling into that stream of what the Civil Rights Movement in the United States and then how it spilled over in Canada. And then it sort of has appeared up again in sort of the anti-globalization movement. And it's the same type of thing. It's representing, in many cases, those individuals, and not always the same ethnic groups, but those individuals who are often blocked from some of the more mainstream labor type of organizing. But on the flip side, there are also those who won't necessarily appeal to the mainstream of a larger movement.
Is there any chance that we'll see a revival of the IWW or of the methods and the principles that they practiced?
I think certainly. I mean, I think right now we're seeing a little bit of that. I mean, we're so caught up in looking at the strength of something by numbers. And I think that's with the IWW, it's a lesson to be learned that it's not necessarily numbers that count, but it's how your message comes out or how effective you are. In the anti-globalization movement, the IWW has actually had new breath breathed into it. It's appealed to youth, which has always been an issue in terms of organizing sort of left. It's had some incredible successes. I mean, the IWW in the United States and Canada is the organization that was the first to unionize in both countries, Starbucks. In New York City in the United States, we're the first, and then in Canada, in Montreal. And that's an incredible thing because unions, both mainstream trade unions and others, have tried for a long time to do this. But here's this marginalized group that people thought had sort of faded in history, and they popped. In the United States also, they were involved in the court proceedings that eventually resulted in Starbucks being fined for skimming tips off of workers, I think somewhere in the Eastern Seaboard. And so those types of things are, in many ways, examples of how the IWW has persisted. And, as much as the left begins to mobilize and more youth get involved but are still blocked, I think there's a space for them.
Well, thanks very much, Michel, for taking the time to talk with us today about this important organization.
Oh, much appreciated. Anytime.
I've been talking with Michel S. Boileau. He is an assistant professor of history at Lakehead University. Michel is the author of Reacting to the Workers' Revolt, the Lakehead and the Winnipeg General Strike, and you can find that article in the journal Left History.